supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Whenever there's a crisis, there are always those running away from it, and others running to it. Today, we're talking about those helpers, the folks who jump into action when tragedy strikes, who they are, and why they do it. I'm your host, Jamie Jay, on Common Space, a collaboration between WHYY and First Person Arts in Philadelphia. There's this great quote from Mr. Rogers. He said that when he was a little boy and the news was scary, his mother would say to him, "Look for the helpers. You will always find people who are helping." To this day, especially in times of disaster, I remember my mother's words, and I'm always comforted by realizing there are still so many helpers, so many caring people in this world. And that brings us to this story, told by linguist Rachel Chafin from the First Person Arts Translation Slam, which took place at the International House of Philadelphia.
It was February of 2011. I was living in Toyama Prefecture, and my year working as an English instructor at the Toyama College of Foreign Languages was drawing to a close. I was actually in preparation to move back to the United States, here to Philadelphia. Two things you need to know about Toyama. First, it is beautiful, surrounded by these huge snow-capped mountains. And the second thing you need to know is that Toyama rarely experiences earthquakes thanks to this mountainous buffer. So even when neighboring prefectures were rocking and rolling, we got barely a jiggle. So when one of my colleagues popped his head into my office and asked me if I'd heard the news about an earthquake in Christchurch, New Zealand, maybe you can understand why my response was, "I'm sure everything's fine. Probably nothing to worry about." It was February 22nd, and a group from our college had just left for Christchurch to participate in a short study abroad program. Earthquakes were a fact of life, and so even when my coworker told me that, it was kind of a big one, my confidence wasn't shaken. "They're fine, I'm sure." They weren't. So my colleagues and I, we made our way down to the school office, and there we stayed glued to the TV, looking for some kind of news. And a lot of the news channels were showing footage from Christchurch. And most of them were showing one building, the Canterbury Television Building. And the CTV building had collapsed. All seven floors had pancaked, and only the elevator shaft was still standing. The CTV building just happened to be the home of the English language school where my students were studying while they were in Christchurch. So that meant that 20 of my students and my two colleagues that were chaperoning them were somewhere in the middle of that mess. The hours that followed passed in a blur. We got on our telephones and we text messaged our students and called them, hoping to get some kind of response. I jumped onto Twitter and, using the hashtag CHCH, tried to get something, anything, from the people who were there on site. And we did get some news the next day. Several of our students and both of the instructors had been found. Both of the instructors and three of the students had only minor injuries, cuts and scrapes. One of my students, a young man, was removed from the building only after a field amputation of his leg. And the others had various crush injuries in varying degrees of severity. Another young woman later had to have her leg removed as well. The others, 13 of them, were yukue fume, missing. That day, the vice principal and one of our senior teachers decided that they would leave for Christchurch, and with them they took a group of the students' parents. But other of the parents had never left Japan, and so they didn't have passports, and issuing emergency passports took some time, so their departure was delayed. 2 days later, at a staff meeting, it was decided that another senior teacher and I would accompany that second group of parents, along with a group of disaster rescue doctors from Toyama to Christchurch. As a native English speaker and someone with proficient Japanese, they decided I could be useful as a representative of the school, as support for the people who were there, and as an interpreter if necessary. I was terrified. I had no idea what to expect in Christchurch. I had no idea what the damage would be like. And the two teachers who had left before me didn't seem to think that we were necessary. They said, "Don't come. You'll be a drain on resources that are stretched thin already." The administration thought otherwise, and so we went. Our group was dogged by reporters on our way from Toyama to Christchurch and then to a city 50 miles outside of Christchurch. Aftershocks were a problem, so they were putting the parents up in a ski lodge turned guest house that was normally closed for the summer. The trip was surreal. And for some parents, as I said, this was their first time having left Japan. And yet, despite this tragedy, the natural beauty of New Zealand didn't escape them. I heard comments like, "Yama ga Toyama mitai da ne. Hitsuji ga osugi desho." It looks like Toyama, doesn't it, if you look at the mountains? Nah, too many sheep. For the next 5 days, I supported people wherever necessary and however I could. I worked with the rescue doctors and the parents as they filled out form after form about their children. Shinshō wa dono kurai desu ka? Taiju wa? Kamiiro to me no iro wa nani iro desu ka? Height, weight, hair color, eye color, distinguishing marks like moles and scars, blood type, dental records, all of these had to be translated into English. When asked, "Doji kiteta fukusō wa oboetemasu ka? Do you remember what your daughter was wearing?" One of the mothers ran upstairs and grabbed a pair of her trousers. "Musume to onaji no zubon o motemasu yo." We had the same pair, my daughter and I. We ended up taking her picture in those pants and attaching it to her daughter's file. Another father was able to describe his daughter's wallet to such minor details as the color and design of the fabric inside. The parents pulled out cell phones and shared picture after picture after picture with the rescue workers. And they told stories, and with each picture and each story, their children were alive and living. They had hopes and dreams for the future. And they continued to do this, even after talk of search and rescue became talk of search and recovery. I woke up early in the morning one day, and I walked into the common room, and I found one of the fathers sitting at a table. He had papers scattered everywhere, and he was drawing kanji, Japanese characters, the same two over and over again, kokoro and wa. Kokoro means heart, or mind, or spirit, and wa translates as peace. Throughout the trip, this father had worked hard to keep his spirits high. He told jokes, and he told stories about his daughter, who was very much like him in that respect. I asked him, "Nani o shitemasu ka? What are you doing?" And he said, in English, "I hope all hearts would be peace." Then I asked him if I could have one of those papers, and he said that he'd make a special one for me. Soon after that, I went with the parents to a military facility outside of Christchurch, where human remains were being transported and stored. Identity confirmation would be a while yet, but 13 were yukue fume, missing. A funeral ceremony in the Maori tradition was held at the fence surrounding the facility. And at the end of the ceremony, Maori elders stood in a line and received mourners with hugs. I thought that the Japanese parents would balk at this. Hugging is intimate and not something that one does with strangers. But I also knew from my own experience living in Japan that being an outsider was hard. And in the face of tragedy, it's almost impossible. So I was greatly, greatly relieved to see that most of the parents welcomed the offer of support, both physical and emotional, that the hugs represented. I returned home to Toyama with many of the parents the day after that ceremony. But before our flight, the father, who had meditatively drawn kanji over and over again, he gave me a paper. On it was wa, peace. He included the translation, and on the back, in English, he wrote, "My present to you." My students are my kids, no matter how old, and any teacher will tell you the same. And this father, even though he was mourning, he also realized that I had lost someone too, 13 someones, and his gift to me was peace. Less than 2 weeks after we returned to Toyama, on March 11th, the Tohoku earthquake and tsunami ripped apart northeastern Japan. Even Toyama felt the quake, which was enough to tell us that it was a doozy. My students had been in the news as their remains had been gradually identified, but they all but disappeared in the face of greater tragedy and impending nuclear disaster. This earthquake confirmed what I already knew, that it was time to go. The day before I left Japan, I visited my tattoo artist in Osaka. All of my tattoos were done in Japan by the same artist, and I wanted one more before I left. I took my paper, and I asked my artist to put wa on my shoulder, using tebori, which is the traditional tattooing technique, hand-poked. I get comments about my tattoos, as most people with ink do. They ask me what the writing on my forearm means. It's a haiku. They tell me that they like the lady riding a fish on my arm. But I don't get comments about this one. I guess people don't know what to make of the abstract scribbly shape that's on my arm. But of all my tattoos, this one has a story. It has 13 stories attached to it. I'll close by saying that wa has one more meaning, and it's an important one. It also represents Japan. This is my tribute to my students and to the country that I will always consider my home. Thank you.
Thank you for your story, Rachel. Our associate producer, Jen Cleary, got a chance to sit down with Rachel and talk a little bit more about her time in Japan and New Zealand. Looking back on the tragedy today, Rachel realized just how much of the story she left out.
There's a lot that's not in there. I didn't really get a chance to go into the anger that I definitely felt and that I know a lot of the parents felt as well, mostly because of the, I hate to say it, it's the media presence. I mentioned it, I think, a little bit in the beginning where I said we were hounded, and it was truly, truly just hounding in the purest sense of the word. There were people sticking cameras to the windows of the bus that we took, both from Christchurch to this guest house, trying to get pictures. It seemed like trying to get pictures of crying or some emotion, or they would come up to the guest house and try and catch people outside. It was, I don't want to call it obnoxious because I don't think that's a strong enough word, but it felt like there was something sacred that was being broken by their presence, and there was always this sort of feeling of anger under everything when they were there, and they were there all the time. They were there when the parents got on a bus to go downtown into Christchurch to see the building. It was maddening just trying to get rid of them for just a little while, but that was a big part of it, was just trying to keep some kind of privacy so that there could be mourning without risk of cameras. Thankfully, at the ceremony, they had people at the gate saying, "Stay out." So that was the only bit of peace I felt like they could get when they knew that they were truly, truly, they were military keeping them out, so keeping the reporters out. There was talk that there were reporters with cameras that bought plane tickets so they could be on the plane with the parents as they flew from Japan to New Zealand. I was incredulous at first, and then as it continued, it turned into anger. I, in particular, had a lot of trouble hiding it. The parents were much more graceful in hiding it than I was. but I'm fairly certain that more than a few of those reporters had a very big, angry-looking Gaijin in their pictures, trying to ruin it for them. But, you know, I felt that was one way that I could protect them.
I have a question for you then. How do you remain resilient through all of that? Because when you're being hounded by the media and you have these translation services that you're providing, how did you not blow up on somebody? How did you just keep level?
Well, I won't say that I didn't blow up, because there were a couple of times when I yelled, and I'm not proud of it, but I do feel like it was trying to protect them so that they didn't have to deal with it. Whether or not that was effective, I can't venture to say. But how do you remain resilient? Recognizing that it's not about you, right? Yeah, it hurt to lose students. But that pain has absolutely no comparison to a parent losing the child. And for a parent to have to relive showing pictures, thinking about where are the moles and the marks and what does their, you know, the inside of their wallet look like, or anything that they can remember, anything that they knew they would have on them. Having to relive that is bad enough. Having to think about how to communicate that is a whole other level of stress that anybody who's learned a second language or has tried to speak in a different language knows. And any kind of mistake or mistranslation can have consequences. So not having to worry about that, putting myself in a position where I can take a little bit of that stress, I feel like was my way of helping them, yes, and taking my own pain and putting it aside and putting in work, right? Focusing on the work. There was a lot of work that had to be done. And so that's how I pushed through. I mean, there at the school, I was helpless. At least by going, I knew I could do something. Hopefully I could do something. So saying no never really crossed my mind. It was always just, yeah, let's go. Let's do something.
In the story, you talk about this father who's doing kanji over and over and over again. And did you ever see him again?
No. I did have an opportunity. When we got back, a lot of the parents held funerals for their children. And he was one of them that held a funeral for his daughter. And I didn't go. At the time, I felt like my presence would be contributing to the circus feeling that was in Christchurch. And I didn't want to bring that up for him. I had said my goodbye already to his daughter. And funerals are different in Japan, I felt. They're very intimate. And I didn't feel like it was my place to be there. So I didn't go. And I do sometimes question whether or not I should have gone or not. But ultimately, I decided not to go. And I do hope at some point, I know that the school holds ceremonies. It used to be every year, perhaps not anymore, remembering those students. And I know that the parents do turn up every once in a while. Perhaps one day I can revisit and see him at one of those ceremonies. But no, we haven't had any contact since then.
Mm. With so much going on right now, we were talking about Vegas early on when you came in here. With what happened in Toyama, what's happening in Mexico.
Yeah.
How do you remain hopeful?
My first reaction is to disconnect, because it seems like nothing good is coming out of the news. Our current president can't seem to stay off of Twitter, and every time he does, I get this pit in my stomach, and I feel physically sick. So disconnecting and getting away from it and trying to see what's real, what's in front of me, that those things, at least for the moment, are okay. Starting there. But hope in general, at least when it comes to disasters, and I know it's going to sound cliche, but that quote from Mr. Rogers, look for the helpers. I love that. I love that. That got me through when I had to go down and help out. I was one of the helpers. Okay, good. I'm doing something. Doing good. People can hopefully see that and take hope from that. And looking for the helpers, looking for the people who are still searching for loved ones in Puerto Rico, still trying to get the infrastructure back online, seeking out those people and trying to find those stories. And unfortunately, doing whatever I can to block out the rest. I know that conversations need to be had, that there is too much tendency to see people who have different opinions from your own and to disregard them, block them, so you don't have to see them. I know that, and I try not to do that as much as I can. But at a certain point, it's overwhelming, just the crush of everything here, abroad. And so I start there. I start by trying to look for the stories of people doing good, people trying to help. And that gives me hope. I mean, I especially try to look for articles that have recommendations for what you can do, right? How do you become one of those helpers? Even if it's sending a small donation, even if it's putting together boxes of things that are necessary and sending it, small things like that, just so you can count yourself among the helpers is a good way to stay hopeful. When I was in Vegas just yesterday, I noticed at a restaurant before we left for the airport, at least two people had bandages on their arms because they had given blood. So that was good to see.
Thank you for everything, Rachel.
Sure. My pleasure.
It's been so good having you here.
I love it. Anytime.
Yeah. Thank you.
You've been listening to Common Space. And that was associate producer Jen Cleary speaking with Rachel Chafin. Rachel is an applied linguist whose home base is the University of Pennsylvania. She specializes in pragmatics and English language use in the biomedical field. Common Space is a collaboration between First Person Arts and WHYY, and it's been supported by the Pew Center for Arts and Heritage. This episode of Common Space was produced by Jen Cleary with Mike Villers. Our engineer was Diana Martinez.